Thank you for joining us for IEB There. And now your host, Randall Rothenberg. Over to you, Randall.
Thank you, John Ward, and hello, everybody. It's 2 p.m. in New York City. This is Thursday, May 14th, and you know that's the time to IAB There. That is our daily live stream in which we connect the digital marketing, media, and advertising ecosystem to itself and to each other. Our topic for today's show is strategies for bringing brands to life during, before, and after the COVID crisis. Our guest today is Jesse Horowitz. Jesse is the co-founder and co-CEO of Hubble Contacts, one of the largest direct-to-consumer brands in the United States, certainly one of the largest and best-known direct-to-consumer brands, and kind of a godfather of the disruptor brand movement. Jesse was extraordinarily influential in getting the IEB's disruptor brand research off the ground, helped persuade our board of directors to welcome brands into the membership of the IEB, and made history in our own small way by being the first brand executive on the board of the Interactive Advertising Bureau. So Jesse is both a patron of mine, a godfather of mine, an inspirer, an inspiration, also one of my bosses and a friend. But I'm still going to ask hard questions. Welcome, Jesse. Welcome to IEB There.
Thanks for having me, Randall.
So I want to start by we're going to talk about your book. You recently published a book called Selling Naked, which is literally wrote the book on disruptor brands. But before I get there, I want to talk a little bit about your personal history and the history of the company. You were a student at Columbia, and you had the idea of creating a contact lens brand, and you explicitly, as I recall, thought about the notion of creating a Warby Parker for contact lenses. How did the idea hit you? Why did the idea hit you? What inspired you in this direction?
So you're giving me a little bit too much credit there. Everything's right about that, except the idea was very solidly my co-founder Ben's. And Ben and I met at Bridgewater. I was a Columbia undergrad, then I was at Bridgewater. Then I was on the investment team for Columbia's endowment for a few years. And while I was at Columbia's endowment, I worked lots of good things about endowment work, very interesting. You're looking across the whole investment universe, all alternatives, yada, yada, but also very predictable, structured work lifestyle. And so during my years at Columbia, I kicked the tires with multiple friends on projects that they were looking at. I was working on a dating app for a while with a friend from Zynga, a biotech company that actually is up and running now that I'm on the board of. And Ben was a friend of mine from Bridgewater who ended up at Harry's, the men's shaving subscription company. So that, which was actually co-founded by one of the Warby guys. And so that was the through line there. And sort of mid 2015, early 2016, he started kicking the tires on contact lenses as a box subscription category. And we kind of dived in together.
Now, let's go a little bit deeper into this, because there's a through line here. You mentioned Warby. Warby leads to Harry's. Harry's leads to Hubble and a lot of other companies. So it's almost as if Warby is the ground zero of a new business movement, possibly in the same way, if we're going to try for a historical analogy, the way Ford Motor Company was kind of ground zero for the 20th century industrial economy. What were the essential discoveries that Warby made that Ben and others and you kind of picked up on and said, you know, these are extensible into other categories?
Sure. So I think it's as much location as you know, as discoveries, which is you had Warby as one of the most successful New York-based startups in its vintage, and direct-to-consumer as, you know, you had meaningful investment by the city and other stakeholders in wanting a more robust startup tech community in New York. And you had Warby launch as one of the more successful in the space. And I think it's just It's just a model that lent itself to New York really well, because New York was already obviously a media hub and a marketing hub, and at the same time a finance hub. And you know, these are all direct response marketing businesses. And so it's a model that lends itself really well to the intersection of those two, because the primary skill sets you're drawing on are digital marketing on the one hand, and media knowledge, and sort of pretty basic financial math on the other hand, of needing to know as you're deploying marketing dollars as an investment what the return's going to be, and whether you're deploying those dollars in a way that you'll make a profit, and at what scale you can continue to deploy those dollars and be profitable on them. And so I think, something that was sort of a modeler's delight plus marketing was well suited for New York, and it makes sense that a robust ecosystem kind of developed around it.
So one of the comments that I've gotten back a lot as we've developed our research over the past several years is, direct response, that's existed for 100 years. There's no difference between these companies and, say, L.L. Bean. Is that true? Or is Hubble just like L.L. Bean? Or do Hubble and Warby and others represent a deviation or a departure or an evolution?
I actually agree with that. And I think one of the main immaturities of the space still is, I think there's major room for more incumbent direct response marketers to fully integrate sort of this novel toolkit on the marketing side. And something we've seen, one of our investors in Hubble is a large, is a major player on replacements on Anderson Windows. So that's a very successful traditional direct response business, decades of success on direct response TV and direct response mail. And he's worked with one of our marketing agencies on the Hubble side to sort of build out a robust Facebook strategy. And that was something that they had struggled with for a long time, because the transitions were obvious. If you're commerce, Nike transitioning to direct to consumer makes more sense because it's transactional. I think a lot of the most successful direct response businesses are lead generation, and the transition for them has been rockier because so much of the Facebook infrastructure is built around the purchase and the transaction, and you need to create surrogates for that kind of funnel to get it to transition to other direct response advertisers. But I think there's a lot of both upside for advertisers, upside for publishers, in that it's another source of ad revenue, and upside for consumers in that, those are valuable businesses that are providing good services, but yet they have to adapt at least a portion of their marketing budget to the new playbook and the new strategies to sort of remain relevant and transition that spend.
Let's talk a bit about those strategies. You talk quite a lot about this in the book. So I want to give a plug to the book right
now. Plug away.
Yes. It's Selling Naked. It's published by Crown, a division of Random House, one of the most important business book publishers in the United States, published the last book I worked on. It's essentially a combination of a personal history and a how-to guide for launching direct-to-consumer brands. So when we talk about Hubble and Jesse Horowitz and DTC Brands, we can say that you literally wrote the book. You've talked about the playbook. What would you say are the two or three essential components of that playbook? And talk about it in language that sure. I can tell my dad, who was in the shopping mall research business all his life. What are they?
So everybody focuses on sort of the digital marketing blocking and tackling tactics. I think most of the game is decided before you even start playing. It's consumers are really smart. Consumers are really sharp. And do you have a proposition that's going to give them good value for money? And secondary to that, in terms of sustainability of your business, can you give them that value for money with a margin structure that's going to work for you? And I think that those are far and away the two most important things. And you can figure out the rest of it from there. But I think too many people believe that.
It's true of any business.
Yeah, of course. It's just business. It's just business. Too many people believe that you can, you know, sort of compensate with storytelling and with design and overcome those barriers. And you can scale that way, especially, you know, which has been less and less true of late in the space. And I think a good thing if you have massive venture dollars behind you. But to build a great business, you know, one of the businesses I'm on the board of is called Mockingbird. It's a stroller business.
Baby strollers.
Baby strollers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the goal with that business was to create something more affordable for the consumer that had a sort of, pretty complete stack of premium features for a premium stroller. And that wasn't something that was on the market. And Eric Osman, the CEO of that business, has done a great job on, you know, he came from Harry's as well. He was on the growth team at Harry's. So he has sort of all of his marketing chops in place. But by far the most important thing he did was partner with people who really knew strollers, who had spent decades in the category, who could help with, you know, he sort of brought the vision on what he wanted the product to be, but who could help sort of do that design from a technical perspective, had scaled relationships with manufacturers, all the rest. And that's all the boring stuff that you don't see, but it means that he has cogs in place to make his price structure work at a price that is very attractive to the consumer.
But so you're hitting at the, I think, the first use or meaning of the word naked in the title of the book. I mean, your point is that you're going to be found out. If you're no good, you'll be found out really quickly. There goes your company. If you're really great, you'll be found out. Your company will scale. And I think that that's kind of a response to one of the other things you hear a lot. This is like the Chinese drop shipping business. You know, stuff gets manufactured, you know, to any old piece of crap, and it gets delivered. And if it's no good, they just move on, create a new name, boom. And you're saying it's almost exactly the opposite is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's that realization is creating all sorts of interesting ripples in financing of the space, because the thing that investors really liked doing, because it felt reliable, was, okay, find a business that's subscale where they're deploying the marketing dollars at a profit and give them a bigger marketing budget. And we're going to, you know, finance them up the wazoo, and they're going to put that into marketing. The problem with that is when it's working, the return on the marketing dollars is so high that it's just not true that the need is on financing the marketing budget. And so then if the thing that needs financing isn't the marketing budget per se, because the return on those dollars is so high that they're coming back to you at a really fast clip, the thing that needs financing is working capital for inventory. Yeah. And that's much more shot in the dark kind of exercise, which is, did I find the right partners? Are we competitive on cost of goods? But then also, as I'm trying to increase conversion on my site over time as I scale, am I making the right decisions on increasing the catalog where I'm not going to have wasting inventory, and I am going to get that site conversion increase? And that's, investors have been much less keen to dive into that kind of risk, which is unfortunate, because that's really for a great direct-to-consumer business, that's really the risk that exists. I think you had...
But that's a classic consumer product risk. That's all consumer goods companies will face.
Exactly. But that's the real risk here. And what I think you saw a lot of was in sort of the mega bucks venture boom in the space is you give a company, okay, you say, great, a company can spend $10 million a year on marketing at a 3+ return on ad spend. Let's give them $50 million a year to spend. And the problem is they can't deploy it. And so then you just see the return on ad spend plummet. You don't get a meaningfully bigger business. And you're not taking risk because you're deploying into something that you modeled already, but the math isn't there. I mean, I think you had Randy Goldberg from Bombas on earlier this week.
Yes, Randy was here.
Yeah, Bombas is a perfect example of getting this all right, which is that's a business. They start, they always had great return on ad spend. They started with a relatively limited collection of product. They learned their consumer better over time. They refined the product. They increased the product catalog, and that's how the business grew. And they were, you know, until they were at the point where they could have a major liquidity event, they were never in demand. You know, that was not a business that people were lining up to finance, because who wants to take a shot on, you know, three random guys, you know, having good insights on what next year's sock collection should be. But that, like, when these businesses are being run right, those are the, you know, those are the real risks attached to them.
And the, not only are they manageable risks, yeah, but they're also transportable across categories. One of the things that you've done is you've not just wrote the book, you've created a platform for other D2C brands, Bazaar. Yeah. You've invested in and are on the board of several companies. So, I mean, that was one of the kind of the research points that led me and us to the conclusion that that disruptor brands are, in fact, a sector unto themselves, that they have more in common with each other than, say, Hubble has in common with other contact lens companies.
Yes, I think that's right. But I think what's interesting now is you have, you know, this gets to sort of what's going on now, which is you have all these, I think one of the biggest thing, if you think about sort of the universe of suppliers over here, all the people who could be producing product either under existing brands or new brands for this channel. Channel conflict has been the biggest barrier, I think, for more people dipping their toes in here. And now you have this massive retail, this massive retail implosion and, you know, and channel disruption, which most of retail will, you know, likely come back, but it's still going to be, you know, it still feels like it should be a meaningful hit. And the cost of that channel conflict just went down, the cost of risking that channel conflict just went down. The opportunity cost of not stepping in on the other side just went up. Do you start seeing, because there's so many good, whether they should be doing it under existing brands or new brands, whether they need new offerings, there's so many people who are out there and organizations out there, Fortune 100, but also smaller players who are really expert on product, expert on supply chain, who should be bringing that expertise either on their own or in partnership with founders on the digital marketing side to bear. And I think a lot of the question has been, okay, if this is going to be 5% of my sales and it's going to piss off the other 90%, is it worth it? But hopefully people are seeing that this really is a channel with massive momentum behind it. And in a place where they should, you know, really do need to play.
I want to get to what you're seeing in terms of the trends in the marketplace now. But as a preface to that, you took a minority investment from Colgate-Palmolive, mm-hmm, a year or 2 years ago. So you became one of their exploratory pathways into this. Have you been getting calls from them, from others, incumbent brand, saying, you know, now's the time we can really use your help and your guidance?
You know, it's interesting. I've been having more conversations the last 2 months than I, you know, did the year before that, but it hasn't been the Fortune 100 of the world. It's been, I've been spending time, for example, a small shoe brand based out of San Francisco. These are folks, they started off, they had a few shoe retail stores in San Francisco. They developed their own sort of high-end private label brand alongside that. And now they're thinking, and they've just sort of been taking the organic search that, you know, that comes from their existing business and been operating it profitably for the last few years. Now they're thinking, okay, is this the time that we really lean into this and want to scale up? We've been spending time with a New York coffee chain. It's going to be a bit of time for New York coffee chains, but a small New York coffee chain that had gone sort of lower cost, no seating in their model. So premium coffee, no seating, smaller footprint. Is this the time for them really to be leaning in with more digital promos to get app installs? Spending a bunch of time with Andrew Yang's team, who's been doing fundraising on the COVID side and trying to understand, okay, they had, you know, good Twitter game, good email marketing game. How did they port that over to sort of a paid social world? So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on right now, but it's not, you know, and definitely a lot more inbound than there, you know, than there was. But I'd say a lot of the most fun conversations have been sort of those, you know, smaller, scrappy organizations that have real sort of category expertise, institutional knowledge, but also, you know, flexibility to experiment pretty radically.
So one of the memes that's been circulating, it's actually there are two memes that have been circulating that contradict each other about the DTC space, and I'm interested in your observations on this. There's a one point of view that says, oh, this is going to be the death of D2C brands because they're not going to be able to sustain themselves in the face of declining consumer spending. This is where the big brands with the bigger propositions are really going to rise to the occasion. There's a completely opposite point of view delivered with equivalent authority and sobriety that says, this is the death of all incumbent brands, the D2C brands that have real communications and community with their consumers, that understand service and consumer trends and understand the new channels for communications and delivery, will rise above and triumph. What's the reality of what's happening in the market right now?
So I think both are true. I think one of the things that's best for direct to consumer right now is winter really kind of started a year or two ago for us. If you look at financings in the space and up rounds. And so you had a lot of businesses started in the last 2 or 3 years that weren't, you know, figure whatever, 2013 through 2016. And, you know, hopefully we caught sort of the tail end of that, was just this, you know, financing bonanza in the space. You have a lot of really great businesses that were started with very different capital expectations that are operating with basically zero fixed costs. And those guys are just killing it right now because the wallet share is there. You know, the wallet share is there and growing. Their overhead is minimal. CPMs are lower, and consumer, you know, and consumer loyalty and repeat rates and retention rates are higher. And so it's really that group that's just, you know, taking it from all sides. You know, that's just winning from all sides.
Some examples that leap to mind.
Sure. So Mockingbird's been doing great. Andy has been bringing them on the board. It's been great in a really troubled category right now. Black Wolf Nation, men's skincare brand, hitting records, you know, month after month. Cheers, a hangover supplement, had a tough run at the start of Corona. Gosh darn it, if everybody didn't keep drinking at home. These are all businesses that raised, you know, less than a million or low single digit millions of capital, that are scaling rapidly on the back of this and on the back of the environment that exists right now.
So, tell us what else is changing. Obviously we're the IEB, we're very interested in marketing communications, advertising, media channels. Most of the DTC brands that have, kind of risen in prominence over the years launched on the back of Facebook or Instagram or both. In our research, we began to see in a year three or 3 to 5, you start seeing less reliance on the Facebook family, more experimentation with other channels. But you've been very much a proponent of Facebook as a extraordinarily viable platform. Tell us what's happening in terms of the platforms, I'm very interested in whether new platforms like TikTok have potential.
Yeah.
What are you seeing?
I think it's really, and I think it shows the strength of Facebook and Google and digital generally. And Ben Thompson at Strategy had a great post on this a couple of weeks ago, which is, as best I understand, and you know better than me, I think TV CPMs are still pretty flattened at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw digital CPMs come way down, but then you saw them rebound pretty quickly because in a direct response environment where the return on the ad dollars are pretty high, people pull back. But then as long as people see the return coming back, they're going to plow right in. And so it's still, what's interesting is if the first part of this was all about lower CPMs and the opportunity in lower CPMs. Now it's genuinely about more consumer engagement, you know, just more consumer activity online than before. Different, maybe higher value consumers, later adopters coming into the channel than before. And so to me, that's been the really interesting, you know, as we kind of push into month three of this, is the 40% CPM discounts that we were seeing in March have gone away. But other dynamics have come into play to continue to make it sort of a really strong environment where we're just a little bit less of the sideshow, more sort of front and center. And then in terms of, I mean, it's still, you know, Facebook and Instagram are, you know, it's still Facebook and Instagram. It's always been Facebook and Instagram. I've heard some folks having some success with TikTok. TikTok's super young on demo, and we're pretty squarely 25 to 45. So we're, you know, not old, but we're a little past the TikTok demo. Still not hearing much success on Snap. Occasional story of success on Pinterest.
What are you seeing or hearing from others about OTT video, the Rokus, the Hulus, and anything streaming?
The CPMs are just so high, and I think it's, you know, it's great if you're if you're P&G and you're spending, you know, billions of dollars a year on TV with no measurement, and this gives you at least some of your traffic with meaningfully more data, you know, and measurement behind it. I get the CPM premium. I think the problem is the CPMs are worth so much to those, you know, the impressions are worth so much to those guys where they'd like more visibility on a small percentage of their video spend. That at least for us, it's been hard to make the math work. If anything, it's been more, different affiliate network, you know, sort of just different traditional, you know, affiliate networks on the publisher side that have really paid off during this period and have been sort of a larger channel than they were before.
Mm-hmm. What are the, in terms of categories, what do you think, there have been some categories that have been slower to move into D2C than others, or viewed from a different perspective, consumer resistance has been somewhat higher in certain categories than other categories. So for example, in food, food boxes were an early mover, yeah. but fresh food, not so much. That, of course, exploded. So what do you think is going to happen now in kind of classic packaged goods categories?
I think it's all just, again, I think it's all just about the biggest challenge in transitioning from retail world to direct-to-consumer world is your percentage margin isn't what matters anymore. It's your dollar margin. And I think that's really, I think it's less about consumer resistance category by category and more that the categories that were maybe high percentage margin but low dollar margin just aren't as natural a fit unless you can figure it, you know, obviously, you know, a sad end to the story, but I think this is what, you know, Brandless was trying to solve, which is, all these things that consumers have no opposition to buying online, but there's just each one of them doesn't have enough dollar margin embedded in it. And so you really need to roll up a bunch of that to free up the kind of dollar margin net of shipping, to cover sort of digital CPMs. But that's why I think there's a lot of opportunity on sort of the bigger end ticket end of the world, premium home repair, financial services, you know, whatever, annuities, life insurance. I'm surprised you're not seeing more plaintiffs lawyers. All these sort of bread and butter direct response advertisers who have thrived on TV for decades. Mm-hmm. Who have super high, customer lifetime value is attached to them. That there's real opportunity for them to move over just because they should be whales in the auction. Come in and outbid lots of folks with the kind of, you know, value that they can provide, the number of value dollars that the customer assigns to them.
Mm-hmm. So professional services then is a category. So we can kind of look at
Yeah.
This old history, this goes back, you know, 20, 30 years of the ambulance chasing law firms. But you're suggesting that you can actually go upstream into that, into those services categories.
And so I think
it's not bottom feeders, and actually make a go of it.
And I think it's interesting. I think it'll be interesting because I think there's lots of things that search unbundled. If you were, if you were a local exterminator, there was no, you could hang your, you could hang your own shingle on search ads, and there got to be, sort of less advantage to being associated with a national brand. If you're talking about extermination, there's meaningful efficiencies to be gained for all the exterminators to advertise together under one brand.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about a top of funnel digital setting versus a bottom funnel sort of search oriented digital setting.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's interesting opportunities in terms of how those service providers organize themselves from a from a marketing perspective.
But this would suggest then that say a McKinsey could be disrupted by a DTC.
Yep.
Right. That's an interesting proposition.
McKinsey would be a great one now that we're all sitting at home on Zoom anyway. all you need is a dozen kids with fancy degrees.
Yeah, and somebody who knows how to sell them, and somebody who knows how to run the job. But yeah, I mean, it's true, because so much of that business is already a virtual business, although so much of it is actually also done on site. But since nobody can go on site.
Nobody can go on site.
Right. Really interesting. Yeah. Hey, looking back, just kind of one last thread I want to look at. If you were starting Hubble today in this environment, given everything you know, but if you were starting it today, what would you be doing differently than you had to do back in 2016?
I think Hubble would be very hard to start today. I think you really needed the financing environment that existed in 2016. Subscription can be profitable, but subscription, you're talking about, you have to finance a cohort to profitability, and that takes some time. And the financing environment in 2016 was very helpful on that front. I think the biggest difference would be, which you're seeing a lot of the successes in, is businesses with enough margin dollars in the first to be profitable on the first order.
Mm-hmm.
That takes a lot of the financing needs out of the business. I think for the most part, when we've thought about other businesses, that has been a major factor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I want to thank you for joining us on IAB there today. It's been great to have you. Thank you for being on the IAB board. Remember, we have a board meeting on June 2nd. It's about Washington. It's no longer in Washington. So we'll be coming back to you with the agenda soon enough. Anything you would like to leave the audience with of what they should be looking for if they're as consumers, not just professionals, but as consumers?
First off, plugs. Book Selling Naked. Also hopped on Twitter the last couple of weeks. So I'm up there now. I'd say most consumers still probably haven't brought, a large percentage of consumers have never bought from a direct brand before, have never purchased off an Instagram ad. If you haven't, try it, because it's a large enough experience at this point that it's worth knowing what the flows feel like going through a Shopify store and getting a product from a no-name company instead of Amazon. Might like it, might not, but it's a relevant experience today.
Great. Well, with that, I want to thank you, Jesse Horwitz, co-founder, co-CEO of Hubble Contacts, IAB board member, joining us on IAB There. I will talk with you again very, very soon.
Thank you. Have a good one, Randall.
Thanks. On tomorrow's IAB There, we're excited to welcome Doug Weaver, the CEO of Upstream Group, where we'll discuss effective selling strategies during this time of crisis and disruption. There is no better teacher of sales technique than Doug Weaver. If you're in sales, if you're thinking about it, if you are a buyer of what sellers sell, you ought to tune in, because Doug Weaver knows his stuff. IAB There is a production of the Interactive Advertising Bureau. Our show today was produced by Connor Healy, Joe Ounce, John Ward, and Tawfiqa Mohinuddin. I'm Randall Rothenberg, the CEO of the IAB. Thank you for watching, and come back tomorrow, because if it's 2 p.m. Eastern time on a weekday, you know it's time to be IAB There. See ya.